I heard a story a couple weeks ago now about an interesting phenomenon in really college and NFL football. You might say, out of the last 20 years, 16 of those years were primarily dominated in college football by one team. One team out of the last 20 years dominated college football for 16 of those years, and that was Alabama. Hands down, every year they had some of the best recruiting, best players, the coaching was incredible. And whenever somebody would beat Alabama, everybody else would cheer just because it didn't happen that often. And so you might go back and watch I think it was Clemson who played them, and he caught the missed field goal in the end zone and ran it back for 109 yards, and the commentators are going wild, and it was incredible because they beat Alabama and they did it on this great play. But the thing about Alabama, they turned into this powerhouse because of their coach, really, Nick Saban. But there was a story that I had never heard. It was the reason Nick Saban went to Alabama. You see, because Nick Saban, before he went to Alabama, he was the coach of the Miami Dolphins. He was the coach of Miami Dolphins for only 2 years. He coached for 1 year at Miami. He'd come from college where he did great, won a national championship. Miami snagged him up, and they were hoping he could do that again in the NFL, and he was doing pretty good. I mean, he led the Dolphins to a winning season, to the playoffs, and they wanted to do it again the next year, but they were in need of a quarterback. And this quarterback came available. He was a guy from the San Diego Chargers, but he was a guy that nobody really wanted because they thought he was too small. He was 6 foot, so they thought he was too small. They thought his arm was too weak, and he couldn't throw for very long. And on top of that, this guy had just had shoulder surgery. And so the Chargers wanted to dump him. So they offered him money that was less than what he was worth in the NFL at the time. And Saban saw that and said, we can get this guy for a steal, and he will fit right in. We can build our team around. He's going to be phenomenal. And so Nick Saban, I mean, he was still the great Nick Saban. I mean, not like he is today because Alabama, but at the time he was still revered around even the NFL. And so when this quarterback from the Chargers came available, he said, I want to go play for Saban, you know, at Miami. I mean, that could be great. And there was one other team interested in him, the New Orleans Saints. They had just pulled out this new coach that nobody knew. He was untested. Nobody really knew much about him, a guy named Sean Payton. And he's like, well, I can go to New Orleans, whatever. I can go to Miami with Nick Saban. And he was pumped. And so he went down there to meet with the Dolphins, his quarterback. And before they worked him out, the management, not Saban, because Saban wanted him desperately, the management of the Dolphins sent this quarterback to the doctors because they wanted to check out that shoulder. They wanted to see if he was going to recover before they put all this money into him. And the way he told the story, his quarterback told the story, is they sent him to the doctors and they ran 6 hours of tests, like not running a test and then sitting and waiting. It was test after test after test after test for 6 hours. They ran him tests, and then they didn't even work him out. They sent him home. And the doctors for the Dolphins advised the management, and they told him, this guy, there's only a 20% chance he's ever going to throw the football again. And if he does, it won't be very long. He's going to re-injure that thing, and it's a waste of money. And so the management passed. They said, we don't want you. And Saban was livid. I mean, he said all kinds of things to the ownership and management, and they pulled this other quarterback, and he quit 1 year later because they didn't give him the quarterback he thought would do well. And he was right. They did abysmally after that. And he went to Alabama, and the rest is history as far as he goes. But this other quarterback, like I said, there was only one other team interested, New Orleans. So he goes to meet with New Orleans because the Dolphins passed. His expectation, his number one team passed on him. He's like, well, I guess I'll go look at the backup plan. I mean, it's New Orleans, whatever. You know, it's hot and humid and muggy and gross. And so he goes down there to meet with the team, and he met with them, and they worked him out. I mean, they actually worked him out. And he went to go eat with them, with the coach and some of the staff, and they were driving back to the offices at the stadium. And this was shortly after Hurricane Katrina. The town was still in disarray. And he said, we got lost in a neighborhood. Quarterback telling the story. He and his wife in the back of the car, and they get lost in this neighborhood. And they see houses off their foundation. He tells the story that he saw a truck that was upside down in the middle of a house. And he said, it wasn't just to see all the property damage, but then the people out on the streets and just the dejection on all of their faces, the hopelessness, he said, was overwhelming. But what also set this quarterback apart was he and his wife were devout Christians. He got saved when he was 17, and his faith was instrumental in the rest of his life. He says, so we saw all of that driving around. We finally made it back to the offices. They gave us an offer, and we went back to the hotel, and we prayed. He and his wife got down on their knees, and they prayed. And they prayed, and they prayed. They said, I know we were expecting Miami. We were expecting to go down there and be a dynasty under this coach. He said he looked at his wife and said, I really feel the Lord wants us to pick New Orleans. And she said, good, because I think the same thing. He said, because I feel the Lord calling us here, not because we can do great things in football, but because of how devastated the city is. This is bigger than football. This is more than football. And so they chose New Orleans. And that's Drew Brees. And they went to New Orleans, and the first year he was in New Orleans, first year back in the Superdome, after the Superdome, it had those people in it after Katrina, and the thing collapsed and killed all those people. First year back in the Superdome, they go to the NFC Championship game for the first time ever in the history of the city. And it was unbelievable. He said just to see the people was amazing. But then a couple years after that, they made it all the way to the Super Bowl. Never been. Saints, never been to the Super Bowl. They make it to the Super Bowl, and they're playing against Peyton Manning and the Colts, which some of you may not know that, who they are. But they were just one of the unstoppable teams. If you went against Brady and the Patriots, or you went against Peyton and the Colts, you were going to lose. It was just a matter of how much. And so they're in the Super Bowl, and Drew Brees threw a perfect game, just about. I think he had two of his receivers drop passes. Besides that, it was a perfect game. And they won. The Saints won. He said, especially somebody not being from New Orleans, he became the face of New Orleans for them. He said when they flew home to see the people's faces for a couple years before, everybody seemed hopeless. To now, everybody expressed joy. Even if they were just financially ruined, to see the Saints do what they did was unbelievable. And the thing was, when Drew Brees, and having that platform and that opportunity, everywhere he went then, people invited him in because they wanted to see him because he's Drew Brees and he led the Saints to the Super Bowl and he told everybody about Jesus. Yeah, I didn't do this because I'm great. He says, I did this because of Jesus. And let me tell you about my Jesus. Even a few days ago, he was inducted into the NFL Hall of Fame. And you know what he spent most of his speech talking about? Jesus. He told his testimony, getting saved at 17, and how Jesus led him through. He had three pastors who were influential in his life, and he invited his family to the thing and the pastors. And they're sitting there on the second row of his NFL Hall of Fame induction. Because for him, his life was all about Jesus and not about football greatness and all the Pro Bowls and all the awards and the Super Bowl. It was about what Jesus could do. And he pushed it all back to that one decision where he and his wife had to give up what their expectation was and embrace the path that God had for them. Because the path that God had was better than what they thought. They had to trust that God knew what he was doing when God led them to New Orleans. And trusting God is a decision that we all have to make. And as we're going to see in today's scripture, even when we know who God is, sometimes we can allow our expectations to overpower that trust. And those expectations can do great damage to what God intends. So open your Bibles today to Luke chapter 2, verse 41. If you're using a Bible on the pew rack, it's on page 858. And if you need a Bible, you don't have one, or you need one you understand, please take one of those home. That can be your Bible. Or if you need a different Bible with study notes or larger print or a youth Bible or kids' Bibles, we have them all in the office. We're just about fully stocked with all of them. We'd love to send you home with one for free. So come and see me or Pastor Jared after the service, and we'll make sure you get one of those when you walk out of here. But Luke chapter 2, starting in verse 41, you see, at this point, Jesus, he's been born. Mary and Joseph have Jesus. They have him in Bethlehem. They set up shop in Bethlehem. But then, you know, the shepherds came. A couple years passed. The Magi came, brought the gifts. King Herod, you know, paranoid out of his mind, decides to kill every baby boy in Bethlehem. Joseph is warned in a dream. God warns him in a dream. Joseph takes Mary and Jesus, and they leave. They go to Egypt for a little while until Herod dies. Then God comes to Joseph again in a dream and says, hey, Herod's dead. You can go home. And so Joseph packs up, and they head not to Bethlehem. That was where they set up shop after the taxes situation. They went back to their hometown, Nazareth. And they went back, and they lived in Nazareth. And they raised Jesus in Nazareth. And during this period of time, we only have one story from Scripture about what takes place during the ensuing years. From when Jesus was born until he was 30 years old. So during those 30-year period, really I guess 28-year period, because he was 2 years old when the Magi came, we only have one story from that period of time. That's what we're looking at today. Look at verse 41 of Luke chapter 2. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. Now this is interesting because only the men were expected to go to Jerusalem for the feast of the Passover. It was like an 8-day deal, and only the men were expected to go back, but Mary and Joseph both went. And I would anticipate that if you were raising the Son of God in your house, you would want to make sure everything from the Old Testament was fulfilled. I mean, you would be scouring the scrolls to find out all of the law and all of the expectations, and you would be doing it to the letter. And so Passover comes up. Mary and Joseph, I mean, it's not even an issue. A fight or disagreement. We're going together and we're bringing Jesus. He's the Son of God. We're taking him. We're making sure this happens. So it says every year they went, all three of them would go to the feast. Verse 42. And when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. So they did it for 12 years. Or I guess a little bit less because they came back after having been in Egypt. But every single year they would go to Jerusalem. They'd make the journey. It was like a 3 or 4 day journey from where they lived in Nazareth to Jerusalem, probably a 4 day journey. If you've ever been anywhere with kids, it usually takes longer than you think. So it's probably a 4 day journey as they would get to Jerusalem. Look at 43. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it, but supposing him to be in the group, they went a day's journey. But when they began to search for him among their relatives and acquaintances. Now, you might say, if they go a day's journey was like 20, 25 miles. If they go a day's journey, how can they go 20 or 25 miles and not realize Jesus is missing? I mean, they're raising him in their house, and he's the Son of God. I mean, I'd put five air tags on him. Like, we're knowing where he is. We're not losing him. But if you've been a parent, you know sometimes kids are kids and you go in the store and you can't find them because they're playing hide and seek and they're hiding in the middle of the clothes or they run down that aisle because they saw the Cheerios or whatever. And that just happens sometimes. Well, that's not what was happening here. You see, when they would travel like this, what they would do is, obviously they said there, they would travel with family members and with friends because it was safer in big numbers because it was extremely dangerous back then. To go on a journey by yourself because guys would pop out of rocks and kill you and take whatever you had. And so what they would do is the women and the younger kids would walk up front in this caravan, and then the men and the older boys would walk behind to keep an eye out, you know, kind of a protection thing. And then they would get to where they were going to camp that night, which is obviously what happened here, because they walked that way and neither one realized Jesus was missing. And so it would seem as though Mary thought he was with Joseph. Joseph thought he was with Mary. And they get there and realize, wait a minute, you don't have him? No, you don't have him? And they start asking, have you seen Jesus? Where's Jesus? You haven't seen Jesus? And they realize now, being 20, 25 miles away, a full day's journey away from Jerusalem, we can't find him. He's gone. He's missing. And so they got to go back. Look at verse 45. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. So for 3 days. So it was 1 day journey away, 1 day journey back, 1 day searching the entire city. Now, Jerusalem wasn't a massive city, but it was big. I mean, we're talking the city might have up to 100,000 people, maybe on a regular basis. But during the Passover, it would swell to like 1 million people, 10 times as many people in town. And those people would filter out of town over those few days after the Passover. So it's not 1 million people at this point, but it's still more than normal. And so Mary and Joseph are running all over town trying to find him. And then they walk into the temple, and there he is. He's sitting in the temple. Now, that's important. Because back then, when somebody would sit down, they were the one doing the teaching, which is a very significant posture. Luke includes that for a reason. You look in here, I mean, Sermon on the Mount. What does Jesus do before he teaches a Sermon on the Mount? He sits down. Everybody gathers around him. This is how he would teach. And so here is 12-year-old Jesus in the temple of all. This isn't like some country synagogue. This is the headquarters. This is the temple. He's sitting there. The teachers are gathered around him. The Pharisees, the priests are gathered around him. The rabbis are gathered around him. It also strikes me that he uses the word teacher because in the book of John, there is a guy named Nicodemus who is called the teacher of teachers. He's the teacher of Israel. He may have possibly been here this day. If he was around, he would have been expected, especially the Passover, to be there in the temple. And then, you know, some 18 years later, he's going to be sitting with Jesus asking about how to be born again. And so they're there. They're listening to Jesus. He's asking them questions. Now, you can only imagine Jesus' questions. Because again, you search Jesus' teachings. When Jesus taught, he would teach, oftentimes, with questions. People would come to him and ask him questions. And how would he respond to their questions? With questions. To help them better understand. To get them to really see where their thinking is. And so Jesus is sitting there with them. He's listening to their words. He's asking them questions. But look at verse 47. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. So they're asking him questions too. They're amazed at his understanding. It's overwhelming them that this guy from Nazareth of all places and a 12-year-old, for Pete's sake, is answering with such deep understanding that it's amazing them. The teachers, the guys who are supposed to be the all-knowing, they're supposed to be the experts, and this kid is knowing better than them. They don't rebuke him. They're just amazed at what's happening. But it also strikes me just as much as one of these guys may have been Nicodemus. Some of these guys, because it was only 18 years later. It was 21 years later when they are, I'm trying to think, so 32 minus this, it was later, 20 years later. Some of these very same guys would have voted to kill that guy they're amazed at right there. They were still on the council when Jesus came through 20 years later. And some of those guys would have voted to kill him. And here they are amazed at him, at his understanding, at his answers, at what he's saying to them, at his teaching to the teachers. But they're not the only ones, because who walked in a second ago? Verse 48. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. I mean, you can only imagine, right? You walk in and your 12-year-old is teaching the teachers. I mean, you were frustrated because you couldn't find him. And then all of a sudden, there he is, surrounded by the most important people in the entire country. Supposed to be the smartest guys in the whole country. And he's telling them what's up. They're astonished. But that's not the only thing they're feeling. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so?" Why? Was her question. "Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress." That phrase, great distress, means we've been suffering torment because of this. Why did you do this? Why did you treat us like this? Why did you do this? Their response to Jesus was, why? How often, though, is that our response to Jesus? When he does something we didn't expect, do we sometimes ask him why? Why did you do this? Why did you allow this to happen? Or Mary's same question, why have you treated us like this? And how does Jesus respond to her question? Verse 49. And he said to them, "Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" That phrase "must be" literally means it was necessary for me to be in my Father's house. Didn't you know this is where I was going to be? I mean, I've always wondered, why didn't Jesus tell them ahead of time that's where he was going to be? Like before they left Jerusalem, they probably saw him around. Why didn't he say, "Hey guys, I'm going to hang out here for another couple days. Is that cool?" But he doesn't say that. Jesus just goes to the temple, and that's where he is for those 3 days, teaching the teachers. So they asked him why, and he said, really the question is, why were you searching for me in great distress all over the place? This is where I should be. Didn't you know this is where I would be? You see, Jesus' response almost seems like a reminder to them. When he says, "Didn't you know this is where I would be?" It was a reminder to them about who he was and about why he was there. It reveals that if they had really just stopped and thought about it, they would have known where he was instead of scouring the town and looking all over the place. But they didn't acknowledge, really, in their distress. They didn't acknowledge who Jesus was. They didn't acknowledge where he was going to be. They just started, you know, like a shotgun, going everywhere, all over the place, trying to find him, instead of stopping and thinking about who Jesus is and where he would have been. And that great distress, now I don't know about you, when you're suffering torment and great distress, that really that doesn't focus your mind. If anything, that makes your mind more scattered, blinds you to the reality of what's happening. And so they're going through great anxiety and didn't stop and think, well, he's the Son of God. Where would he be? Naturally, the thinking would, in the temple, of course. But they didn't stop and think about that. They had the Son of God in their house for 12 years, and it didn't register. Maybe that's what's happening, and that's where he is. He's in the temple. Look at 50. And they did not understand the saying that he spoke to them. I mean, he said it, right? He said, why were you looking for me? Didn't you know I'd be there? And they didn't get it. They didn't understand it. I mean, they were told before he was born who he was. They knew who he was. He was Son of God. But 12 years have passed since then. I mean, maybe, as often happens, time and familiarity with the situation kind of clouds our minds, has its toll. Maybe, though they knew who Jesus was, maybe they didn't fully understand how much he was going to affect their lives. They knew who he was, and they had been taught their entire lives when the Messiah comes, he's going to lead an army and conquer the Romans. And now their expectations, the reality of what it's looking like, is really blowing their expectations out of the water. And the reality of living with the Son of God in their house is different than what they thought. They're not raising a military leader. They're raising the supreme authority of all the world. And so when this situation arises, their gut instinct isn't, he's in the temple, obviously, Son of God. their gut instinct is to panic and run amok. Look at 51. And he went down with them, came to Nazareth, and was submissive to them. And his mother treasured up all these things in her heart. Now that phrase makes us think that Luke, who wrote this down, got his info from Mary. I mean, that's a couple other times in the first section here in Luke. It says Mary, like when the shepherds came with baby Jesus and the shepherds came and left, it says Mary treasured up these things in her heart. Here, Mary treasured up these things in her heart, that Luke went and heard this story from Mary. But what blows my mind is this verse. Jesus, Almighty Creator of everything, goes down and submits to his creation. He obeys them. That's what the word submit means. He followed them. When he had just, I mean, didn't quite rebuke them. I mean, he kind of did, but reminded them of who he really is. But he still goes down to Nazareth and submits to them. I wonder why. I mean, he could have possibly been doing it for their benefit, their spiritual benefit. Obviously, because of his response to them, he cares about them. He cares about their own spiritual growth and development. But it may have also been because of who may have been watching him also. Because you got to remember, Mary and Joseph had other kids. And those kids do not believe Jesus is the Son of God until after he raises from the dead. And after he raises from the dead, a lot of those memories from childhood and those interactions with him would have come back to their mind. And they see him now alive, walking among them after having seen him killed. It would have been just a revelation to them. And so maybe Jesus' submission to Mary and Joseph was also for the benefit of his half-siblings there in the house, knowing they would come to believe. And one of them, James at least, would become the pastor of the church in Jerusalem, leading people to believe in his brother's death and resurrection. But he goes down there and he submits to him. Look at verse 52. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. Increased in wisdom, intellectually, increased in stature, physically. That doesn't mean Jesus got smarter. That phrase, increased in wisdom and in his stature, that's just a way of saying he grew up. He grew up. And he increased in favor with God and man. Now, that's also just a phrase. That doesn't mean he got more popular with God. He is God. That means he grew up and matured. He grew up and matured. And so people saw him differently as he grew. But this entire section, as what happens right after this, we get John the Baptist getting ready and then Jesus as an adult, we see this unique interaction with Jesus and his parents, his earthly parents. Jesus really became involved in their lives 12 years before this, when they decided to participate in God's plan to bring Jesus into the world. The angel came to Mary. Mary said, I want to be a part of that. The angel came to Joseph in the dream. Joseph said, yes, I will do what God wants. They decided to participate in God's plan, and Jesus became involved in their lives. And Jesus' work in their lives, even at here, 12 years old, we see that Jesus had a plan for their growth. He didn't just slap them down. He corrected them and showed them the spiritual way forward. But it's similar with us. Jesus' involvement in our lives depends upon his grace and our faith to participate with him. And that's Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. For by grace you have been saved through faith. And this not of yourselves, not of works, so that no one can boast. That is the same thing. Jesus is involved in our lives when we have faith, when we believe, we participate in God's plan. And then Jesus' work in our lives from that day forward depends upon his plans and not our expectations. Jesus' plan, his work in our lives depends on his plans and not our expectations. He wants us to grow. He wants us to have our faith strengthened, to become who he designed us to be. But the reality is, my faith only grows when my trust grows. My faith only grows when my trust grows. And my trust is my acceptance an application of the Lord's plans over my expectations. Trust is my acceptance and application of the Lord's plans over my expectations. Expectations damage my faith because expectations are devoid of dependence and trust. Expectations have nothing to do with depending on God and trusting in God. Expectations demand fulfillment. God, fulfill my expectations and do what I want. But that's completely backwards because God never needs to fulfill my expectations. And it's exceptionally naive and prideful to think that God should have to fulfill my expectations. The reality is I need to participate in God's plans and not He in mine. I need to participate in God's plans and not He in mine. And that's what's happening here with Jesus and His parents in the temple. They wanted Him to participate in their plans. And Jesus said, no, you got this wrong. You got this backwards. And they would need to know that. Because when Jesus would go to the cross and die and then raise from the dead, I guarantee you that was not Mary's plan to watch her son get crucified. But she, by then, was submitting to what God wanted. Even if it was going to be painful and difficult and not her expectation, and it was going to blow everything she'd been taught about the Messiah out of the water, because she was going to have to go back to what does Scripture actually say and realize God's plan is far bigger than what she had heard about. God's plan was about saving the entire world. And so I need to participate in God's plan and not He in mine, in the same way Mary and Joseph had to realize that here. We have to trust Him that His plan is best, because trust grows faith, while expectations remove trust. And with trust removed, faith can't grow. And Hebrews 11:6, it says that without faith, it's impossible to please God. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Only through faith and trust can God be pleased. Trust grows faith, and faith pleases God. And trust is a conscious decision that we make. We don't trust by default. It's a conscious decision. We have to say, I'm going to trust. And we may not fully understand how our lives as they are will be affected by trusting God and what His plans will be. But having faith is deciding to trust God no matter what happens as a result. Charles Stanley, the great pastor, he's in heaven now, but of First Baptist Atlanta, would always say, obey God and leave all the consequences to Him. And whatever happens, happens. He'll take care of all that. You just got to obey God. You got to trust Him that He knows best. Follow the Lord in whatever He wants. Wherever He leads, I'll go. Wherever He leads, I'll go. That's a famous hymn, that phrase, wherever He leads, I'll go. And it comes from the guy who wrote the hymn was actually talking with a friend of his about God's call on his life, because his friend of his was a missionary. And as a missionary, he had come back to America because he was having health problems. And he went to the doctor, and the doctor told him, if you go back to where you're going, I think it was South America, you will die, like, within a year. Your body cannot take what's going on down there. You will die. And as this hymn writer, this musician, was talking to his friend, the missionary told him, he said, I know what the doctor's saying, and I know what my family says. I know what my friends are saying. Don't go, you're going to die. He says, but all I know is wherever He leads, I'll go. So that musician heard that phrase and it bugged him for days. And he sat down and this hymn just like poured out of him. It's wherever He leads, I'll go. Wherever He leads, I'll go. And it's that idea that God will take us where He wants us to go. That's what God said to Jeremiah in Jeremiah chapter 1. God came to Jeremiah and said, Jeremiah, I want you to be a prophet. Jeremiah said, hold up, God. First off, I'm not a good speaker, and I'm way too young. Nobody's going to listen to me. And God said, stop it. I want you to go where I tell you to go, say what I tell you to say, and everybody's response, that's not your responsibility. He says, that's mine. You just go where I tell you to go and say what I tell you to say. And actually what God ends up telling Jeremiah, it's so funny if you go and read it. God says, you go where I tell you to go, say what I want you to say, and I'll just give you a heads up. They're not going to listen to you. Your entire life, they're not going to listen to you. But that's not your job to make them listen. You just say it. And Jeremiah does. People don't listen. They end up trying to kill him. They throw him in a cistern. The city is bombarded by Babylon. And it's actually the Babylonian king, the enemy, who pulls Jeremiah out of the cistern that the king of Israel, king of Judah, threw him in. The enemy pulls Jeremiah out and provides for him and takes care of him. God can use anybody to do anything if we just trust him. We've got to release our expectations and trust the Lord. Is there some expectation that you currently have that you need to release and decide to trust God? But deciding to trust God is not just some simple passive acceptance. Oh, whatever will be, that's fine. No, deciding to trust God is deciding to actively follow him wherever he wants you to go, saying whatever he wants you to say, doing whatever he wants you to do, and trusting him with the rest, trusting him with the consequences. It's deciding to rely on him and go and do it, not just sitting back and letting it happen. Deciding to trust God is an active position you're taking to go and do for him and allowing him to take care of the rest. Jesus says that in Matthew 6:33. Seek first the kingdom of heaven and all these things will be added unto you. That's everything that you need for your life. He'll take care of all your needs. You just have to trust him with where he leads you, with what he tells you to do, where he tells you to go. You just got to trust him and he'll take care of all of it. And so that comes down to the basic question of life. Will you trust Jesus? Will you trust him? Will you trust him with your salvation? That Jesus, the Son of God, came and he died and he rose from the dead so all your sins would be forgiven so you can live after you die. Will you trust him with your eternity? But then you also have to ask yourself, if you are a Christian, will you trust him with your today? Do you trust him enough with your today to give up your expectations about what your day is going to look like, what your week's going to look like, how things are going to play out? Will you trust him with your, with surrender your expectations of how other people are going to act and live and do and say? Because I don't know about you, people don't do what I want. They don't do what I want. Man, life would be easy if they did. They just did this and did this. If the coach of the Cowboys would just take my phone call, life would be so much better for all of us. In my mind. And then they would lose and be my fault. But we just need to trust God with everything and not allow our mood and our attitude to be based entirely on whether or not our expectations are fulfilled. Man, how often do we do that? When our expectations, when somebody doesn't do what we want or things don't go our way or something falls apart and we expected this to happen and it didn't happen, and then it destroys us. Sometimes for days or weeks, or every time we see that thing that could have been, at least in our mind, what if? What if? And then everything would have been different. I was talking with one of my boys about that Drew Brees story I told you at the beginning. Because that, whenever that story came up in all the articles I read about it, it was always the question of what if. What if Drew Brees had gone to Miami and Nick Saban had not gone to the college, had not gone to the NCAA, not gone to Alabama? College football never would have been the same. Never would have been the same. Because of what he did in Alabama affected every other team. Not only that, imagine how many lives would have been different of all those college kids that came to Alabama to play. Would have been different. Hundreds, thousands of people were affected by one decision to trust God. And then imagine what would have happened in New Orleans if Drew Brees hadn't gone there. Lives that would have been changed, impacted, as a result of his message of hope about Jesus that he communicated everywhere. You see, you can't play the what if game. You just got to trust God with it. And whatever happens comes, it will happen and it will come. But if you trust God, then just leave the rest to him. Let him take care of it. Trust him and then leave all the rest up to him. So for you today, will you trust God? If you haven't yet with your salvation, trust him today with your salvation, with your eternity. And come and see me or Jared after the service. He'll be at the back, I'll be at the front. And we want to talk to you about that. Celebrate with you. Maybe you need to trust God with your daily decisions. Drop your expectations about this, that, and the other thing and trust God. What is the thing you need to drop? What's the expectation you need to let go of? And trust him with it. Because I guarantee you, with all of us, there's some kind of expectation we all got about something. What do you need to let go of and trust him with today?